Welcome to the podcast. It's kind of a special episode tonight, actually, and we will get to why that is in just a moment. First, just wanted to quickly, do the usual thing, call out some new followers in Ultima Dragons. Have a couple new followers for the podcast on Podbean this week. We've got Ammo10 and Briona123, so welcome to both. And then there's a few new members of the Ultima Dragons groups on both Facebook and Google+. We have Rodrigo, who also joined the Google Plus group. He joined on Facebook as well. We have Colin, joined the Facebook group. And then also on the Google Plus side, we have Martin. So welcome and splut to all. Splut, the traditional greeting of the Ultima Dragons. It's the sound of a pie hitting you in the face. So you heard a little bit of laughter there. And we're joined tonight. It's actually a weird circumstance because we don't have Linguistic Dragon anymore. He hasn't permanently left, but he's not going to be with us for at least a couple of weeks. So I reached out to Colby and Gordon from Iron Oak Games. So this is the team, some of the team at any rate, behind the game For the King, which some of you who are listening to this may recall. I mean, it's a project that I've talked about on the Ultima Codex a fair bit, and you may recall that it had its origins in a board game adaptation of Ultima 7. There's a picture of it on their Kickstarter page, and we're going to be talking a little bit about that. But you know, first, let's just actually give a bit of a welcome to Colby and to Gordon. Welcome, guys.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks. Great to be here.
All right, so let's just, obviously things are on hold with the Blackgate board game. Let's say indefinitely, because For the King has come along. And I think a lot of what I wanted to actually, what I'd hope to get out of the podcast, and we'll see if we can achieve this, is kind of just understanding the genesis of For the King. And, I know you were working on the Blackgate board game and you were working on the Unity version of the Blackgate board game. Yep. And then suddenly that, paused and For the King emerged out of that. But, just want to briefly call back to a bit of history here. I first posted about the Blackgate board game. I'm looking at the codex now on July 3rd of 2013. And
yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah. And I mean, I first heard about it from my wife's cousin, Troy Archie.
Yes.
Who, it must have been, just based on the dates, it must have been like a family Easter party that he pulled me aside. And he's just like, my friend is working on this board game and it's Ultima. And it's really cool.
Yeah. He told me the story. You guys were at some sort of an event and he saw Ultima on your phone. I think it was like the Codex logo or something like that. And then he started telling you about, my side project and Small World, I guess. It's just the owner of the biggest Ultima fan site on earth just happened to be there. And so, yeah, it was pretty funny.
Yeah, it was. And I mean, he was like ludicrously excited. So, and it was cool because Ultima 7, but as a board game, I wasn't sure how it would work. But when I saw, you put your website up a few weeks later and, when I said, wow, this is serious. this is cool stuff. And it did. It looked like, and the artistry was just, brilliant. Yeah.
Thank you.
And thank you. Thank you in turn for that copy of the map that, you sent to us. Incomplete, though.
Incomplete, yes. Though one day it'll be done. Yeah. I promise you'll get it someday.
It's still gorgeous. No complaints about that. I just got to figure out how to print it large enough to go somewhere here. Anyways, it actually wasn't all that long before the project made the jump to Unity. And you're looking back over my coverage, July 2013.
I think it was November.
Initially. Yeah, November would be about December 3rd is when I picked up the first video. that you released for it.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah.
So the jump to digital came about because I had been getting so many questions about distribution. And it was kind of an awkward topic. I mean, I can't really distribute it legally. And obviously the only way to really do it would be online and to put the components online for people to print themselves. And then I'm imagining people playing with like paper tokens and whatnot. And it just was not sitting well with me. So I was like, okay, I've got a fairly strong technical background. Gord is, he's a close friend of mine and he's got lots of game dev experience. So he knew Unity inside and out. So he helped me learn it. And yeah, I just started making the digital version, and it just went well. It was just kind of like this seamless transition. And looking back, I mean, it was a pretty clunky prototype, but it did work. And so the transition to FTK was then: should I continue dumping thousands of hours into this when I can't distribute anything that says Ultima on it? Should I make my own product? Should I get a team together and just build our own IP and then just, develop our own title? So it was kind of a no-brainer at that point. After having put so many hours into it, it was just, I think I'd already committed. So I had to take the next step, and it was FTK was born essentially.
Yeah. And I mean, I remember seeing like the first few images you threw up on like Instagram.
Yeah.
And I can't remember if you put any on the U7 board game site, but I definitely remember some of the ones on Instagram. And honestly, I mean, you had me fooled. And Gord, if this was your handiwork, because I know you're doing a lot of the art side. But if this was your handiwork, then kudos through and through, because the first few pictures that I saw from the game, I'm just like, wow, these are really cool game pieces. I totally thought that, you had transitioned away from making an Ultima themed board game specifically to making a totally different, like another board game. Just based on the shots that I saw, it looked so much like, some of those tilt shift miniature fakes, or like, close-ups of models.
Totally. Yeah, no, that's, thanks a lot. It's good to hear. That's definitely one of the driving forces behind the aesthetic, is we wanted to sort of maintain that board game feel to it, and really play off tabletop miniatures that you might use in a D&D game, or something that felt sort of tactile and tangible, and really just sort of brought you back to the origins of being a board game. So I'm glad you were fooled.
Oh, I was well and truly fooled. It was, I think Colby had a good laugh at me over that one. That was good. So, all right. So, obviously, that, gosh, when did you make the switch to that? Let me just go back and take a look here. When would it have been about the genesis for, what would have been about the start for the board game? Because I'm trying to think, for the King, rather, because I'm trying to think. The project, the cancellation notice was 17 Feb 2014. That was when I put that news up. And then I noticed you had transitioned to Iron Oak, the name Iron Oak, from Sixth Circle on November 11th of 2014. But I think it was before that. That you actually made that shift.
It was right around the same time. I think I announced the cancellation of the board game. Yeah, probably a few weeks before I really had any pieces in place for FTK. I think it was about March. I contacted the first person I contacted was my friend Sean, and Sean's actually an old friend of me and Troy from high school. So he's a great writer and whatnot. And I think I contacted him March 2014, and he just started working on some new story elements, whatnot, that we can convert into a reskinning of the Black Gate. And it was early in the year, and then Gord joined shortly after. I think it was like April or I can't remember.
Gordon. Yeah, I think it was something around there. Yeah, just in a part-time capacity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Cool. All right. Yeah. So I guess I kind of, cause I noticed, yeah, like late April, there was a little update on the Six Circle Gaming website that you were alive and well. There was no real, I don't recall that you specified, what was being worked on.
Yeah. We were a little secretive for a while. It was up in the air and whatnot. I didn't want to just jump out and be like, hey, I'm working on this thing that isn't clearly defined and you guys have no reason to really care about it yet. So I was kind of holding my cards a little closer and, it was just, you know, the best choice at that time to kind of be secretive and whatnot. And now, of course, we're standing on rooftops shouting it. So,
yeah. And I mean, great work, by the way. Like, you know, you posted that teaser trailer in July of this year.
Yeah.
Announced the Kickstarter coming 2015, and then, you know, you started to put out a little bit of information on the website, noticed a little bit of it, you know, obviously some refinement in the aesthetic a little bit. Now I can see, you know, there's the party of three adventurers, you know, some details do start to come out.
Yeah.
And then, you know, obviously the Kickstarter campaign kicked off the 15th, I guess. Was it the 15th or the 14th?
It was the 15th.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So I did actually get it same day. Wow. That doesn't always happen anymore. But, and that's done tremendously well. I have to say, like, I mean, your initial goal was 40,000. You've hit, I'm seeing, we're recording this on Friday evening, the 25th, and you've hit, 85,181. So you've more than doubled on your goal. That's awesome.
Definitely gone well. We've been pretty pleased with it. I'm just saying we're a little blindsided by it, to be honest. It happened so fast, and you know, we were absolutely petrified before we clicked publish on the Kickstarter page, and it just steamrolled and kept going. And yeah, it was a pretty wild day, that first day.
Yeah, the outpouring of support has been just absolutely tremendous by the community, the supporters and the backers and the comment sections and through emails and messaging. I mean, we've really developed an awesome little tight-knit community already, and it's awesome. It's fantastic, and we can't wait to see where this goes.
Yeah, I was showing the I showed the page to a coworker at my office, and he's a console gamer, prefers stuff in like the Bloodborne Dark Souls category usually. It's, you know, often what he talks about. I think he's working through Metal Gear Solid as well. I showed him the Kickstarter, and he's just like, "This looks so awesome." I think he actually found a way. We have like a web filter, and he must have found a way like around that so that he could, you know, pledge to the project via Amazon payments, because it blocks Amazon.com normally. But he just walks back up to my desk an hour later. He's just like, I totally backed that. So,
well, tell him thanks. That's awesome.
I got to admit, like, you hit, if I recall correctly, just as part of running the codex, I mean, I have this massive, I use Feedly for a lot of my RSS stuff. Used to use Google Reader, but then Google decided to get rid of a good thing. So, but anyways, I follow, you know, easily 100, 125 gaming websites, right? A lot of the mainline ones, you know, your PC gamers and your Euro gamers and your Gamma Sutras, and then sort of a lot of the niche ones too, like, you know, Tech Raptor, Niche Gamer, things like that. And you guys hit your goal. You hit 40K before I saw a single story about you on any of them. Now I'm seeing the news coming out. You know, it's like now I'm starting to see coverage appearing on some of these sites, but it's just like, total word of mouth success for the campaign. But
we had a lot of support from friends and family. I mean, we made a note of letting them know about our campaign and kind of how important it is to pledge the first day to help build momentum. And that was a really effective strategy and something that I would recommend anybody did if they were considering Kickstarter. So they helped immensely. And then, you know, it caused a stampede that first day, and I totally credit them for it. And yeah, it was really fast. It was just a whirlwind that entire day. So it was really, really enjoyable, and we're really grateful for it.
Yeah, we have a PR company handling the press release for us. Being a small team, you know, we don't really have a lot of time for all the marketing efforts and whatnot. And their initial plan was, okay, well, we'll wait a day or two to, you know, release these press releases and do the marketing, because we want sort of some sort of base already in the campaign. So when the press comes, they'll see, okay, there's some traction behind it. But that first day went so quick and so well. They gave us a call, you know, early in the morning. They're like, we're going ahead with this press release, you know, right now. We're not going to wait. We're just going to do it because you guys are rock and rolling. So they sent out the releases, and it probably took about a day or so for, like you said, to start seeing them in the press and on the sites. But it was sort of a testament to just how crazy and how viral it went there right at the start. Yeah, I think we hit our funding goal in just over 24 hours. So it's absolutely amazing. We're so, so grateful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was immense work. Cause I mean, obviously seen many successful Kickstarters, backed several of them. Apparently I just unlocked an achievement on Kickstarter actually when I backed yours.
Oh, nice.
You backed so many games. Gamification for the win. But, I've also seen a lot that have failed, including some that, you know, Chris Taylor, you know, the guy who gave us Dungeon Siege, couldn't pull off a successful Kickstarter. You nailed your goal in a day. So that was good.
It's a mysterious world for sure. I mean, your presentation has to be on point, and, you know, you have to have gameplay to back up what you're talking about. And I mean, I think a lot of people are a little hesitant to back any projects that don't have like established gameplay in place already. And it's definitely, from what I gather, it's probably not as easy to kickstart as it used to be. So, I mean, you really got to be prepared and, you know, have a solid package put together. And I think, to Gord's credit, he did so much work on the art side of it and whatnot. So he really had the game in a representable state, and it really showed well.
You know, though, I think too, like, it's just looking at all the different graphics on the Kickstarter page itself. Like, I mean, you hit so many. Just there's, what I love is just there's just tiny little details here. Like, you know, there's the animated GIF of Orton, the starting point for the adventure, right? Which I love too. It's the fact that, you know, like, you have this randomly generated world, but there's like this one common starting point, and then. You know, it's like, and the adventure goes, and there's this one story, I guess, I assume, that kind of weaves through the world, but, you know, the layout would like change every time. So it's like, you can kind of keep replaying the story and it'll be a little bit different, I assume, with each experience of it. But just, we can maybe come back to that in a minute. I just wanted to finish this point. Is like, you know, I'm looking at like the Orton GIF, and, you know, just like this beautiful, like, you know, I mean, there's the land, there's the clouds, you can see the little village there. The day night cycle is clearly illustrated, the dynamic shadows. And then just above it is actually, I think, my favorite GIF. So it's just under the adventure banner. You know, so weave your own unique tales in epic single player or multiplayer RPG that spans across the realms. And it's the shot of, I think it's the blacksmith character. He like rolls three hammers and he inflicts damage, like 10 damage, and he knocks out that rock troll or whatever it is, right? But it's the skeleton beside him. It's the skeleton beside him that I just absolutely love, you know, because his head just tracks, right?
Head tracking. I was waiting for you to say it. Yeah.
He looks and then he looks back, and it's just, it's a little detail, but it just, you know, it communicates so much about just the level of attention to detail and design that's gone into this.
He doesn't look very concerned, though, I must say. I mean, he obviously knows what's about to happen here. I'd have turned around and ran, but...
Well, you know, I mean, most... Unless you're... What's that game? Kill the Plumber is another game, I think, that's on Kickstarter right now. You know, unless you're the cast of Kick the Plumber, you know, you kind of, I think, just accept, oh, I'm the bad guy in this scenario. I'm supposed to get toasted by the heroes.
I'm next.
Certain dude.
But maybe just...
Thank you very much, though. Let's...
Yeah, no, that's, I just, little things like that just make these things. So, I mean, obviously I gather that, you know, you are going to want to kind of closely guard things, in terms of plot. So I'm not going to try and tease too much, but was I at least kind of right there in that, you know, like, even though the world's completely randomly generated, there's kind of always going to be, you know, places like, you know, it's the same towns like Orton and wherever else you happen to be going, and they'll just be in like different arrangements each time.
That's exactly it. There's we've got about 9 realms right now, and currently in the pre-alpha state of the game, at any given time, there's only 6 realms. So it'll draw 6 realms from a pool of 9 currently. So, and each realm has its own towns and haunts and sanctums and all these different POIs, we call them, points of interest, that have different mechanics associated with them. So they kind of force you to play your game differently every time, because they all be, you have a different set of tools to use every time. So the story always remains the same. The story is a constant, but it's the mechanics that are randomized, and they force you to play differently, and which results in a completely different adventure every time.
Right. And then in addition to that too, I mean, just looking at, like, you know, your Frost Realm stretch goal, right? Like, that's total, total serpentile, and that, you know, when you walk into the Frozen Lands, like, if you're not properly equipped, you'll die, right?
Yeah.
I'm assuming that other biomes similarly, like, you know, have maybe like equipment based requirements, like, you know, if you're not properly equipped to go in here, then this will happen. Or
I mean, things are still, like, we're still pretty early in development, so we've got a lot of ideas that just aren't quite fleshed out, but something that you would recognize from Ultima would be like swamp boots.
And oh, yeah, okay.
Do we have them in the game right now? No. Do I want them? Yes. So there's going to be poison hexes and whatnot, which we've already got, but I would like to have some sort of like equipable item that allows you to bypass these hexes without any sort of negative effect. So I would love to have some sort of, like, you know, swamp boot system and whatnot, and any sort of other equipable item that allows you to, you know, traverse through, like, the hazardous conditions and whatnot. So we'll see where it goes. It's still fairly early, but we'll definitely be considering many things like that, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like, too, you know, you've got a lot of, you know, crafting systems kind of in the pipeline. You know, a lot of the ability to just, like, find and, you know, combine items and herbs and reagents, if for lack of a better term, to achieve different outcomes.
Yeah. So the crafting system is, again, it's not completely fleshed out, but we've got a pretty solid plan in place for it. And it's going to be a persistent system. So when you find recipes for weapons, you can gather resources and take those resources to this guy called Marvin. And he's like this crazy blacksmith who's also a key plot element of the story. And he can persistently craft you legendary weapons, and the legendary weapons are these things that you'll be able to use in future playthroughs if you've managed to successfully craft them in the past. So it's one of a few persistent elements in the game is our crafting. So it's not something you don't want to, you know, craft the same hammer every single game, because it's just kind of lame. So
right,
you know, we'll have probably a dozen or so weapons that you can kind of work towards and chip away at over multiple playthroughs, and you finally, you know, unlock a recipe for an item you've been trying to get, and then you'll always have that available to you in your future games. So that's kind of how that's going to work.
That's cool. So, you know, cool, you roll a different cast of characters each time, but then sort of you're accumulating this common body of lore and recipes as they go along.
That's exactly it. Yeah.
And then and not only that, but there are other characters, other playable characters that you can find, recruit or rescue or meet through various circumstances. And if you complete certain challenges, then you'll unlock them as well for future playthroughs. So you might unlock a whole different class of character to use. So it is a sort of a common element with the crafting and with the unlocking of the characters and the lore, which is essentially unlocking mechanics in the world. It's a big thing that you're constantly improving the game as time goes on, upping your chances for success.
Yeah. And actually, I mean, you know, you mentioned that, you know, challenging roguelike adventure is one of the listed features. So is this going to be like a case where, with a lot of roguelikes, you know, it's not necessary. I mean, I guess the modern example might be something like Infinity Blade, where it's not, you know, that you necessarily will get through to the end of the game on the set of characters that you start with. Is that kind of how it is? Like, you know, your cast of characters may occasionally wind up dying, and then it's kind of like the next cast that follows them that might continue to advance and get a little further in the plot?
Potentially. We've got some ideas for kind of how our permadeath system's going to work. And as you said, like the characters are completely disposable. Ideally that you can find them and recruit new ones in a single game session. So if you find a hunter in a town that wants to join your quest, then you can bring him aboard. If he dies, well, he's dead. But you could in theory collect a new cast of characters to use that are completely different by the end of the game than they were at the beginning of the game. So yeah, like characters will come and go, and they're just kind of tools that you use to, you know, collect lore in the game and advance the story and advance all the persistent mechanics and whatnot. So definitely don't get attached to your characters, because they will most likely die. And every time you start a new game, you'll be selecting new characters. So that's the plan for that.
Cool. Yeah. And I mean, like, I noticed, like, just trying to kind of keep myself on here. So, and then two, I mean, I like this idea of, like, you know, just the way, like, the world is described, right? Where, you know, you have challenges, or like these haunts and scourges, things that might be time dependent, you know, like they emerge at different times of day, the weather and other natural events. It sounds like you're really building a lot of, you know, dynamism into the world of the game, which is, I mean, again, from coming from, you know, Ultima, this is really nice to see.
Yeah, the scourges are an interesting one. They're essentially like, they're selected to be part of your game the same way like the realms are. Like, there's going to be a large pool of scourges, and each one has like a global mechanic that they alter. Like, we've got one that affects time, we've got one that affects, you know, shop prices, we've got one that simply just stalks you and wants to kill you, and they all kind of cause different types of fear in the game. And when they join the game, it's like they drastically change the fundamentally what's happening in the world, and it alters your goal instantly. Like, as soon as the old one, who was kind of like our Father Time style character, as soon as he's in the game, he is putting your quest in instant jeopardy. And time is such a commodity in our game, and he essentially makes it go twice as fast. And the faster time's going, the more quickly the game's gaining in difficulty. So there's kind of like this wave of difficulty that can swallow you up, and if it surpasses you, then you've really got no hope. So the old one can really throw a monkey wrench in your plans. So there's all sorts of ways that these different scourges come in and definitely screw up your plans and whatnot. So it's pretty interesting. Lots of like interweaving mechanics and causes like just things that create a unique gameplay session every time. So it's pretty neat. It's something we're pretty proud of.
Yeah, it's that dynamism is super important for games like For the King and roguelikes. It's just because every play session we want to be unique, and we want you to sort of have a unique adventure and something unexpected. And so by introducing a lot of these sort of dynamic systems, they play off each other, and sometimes they play off each other in ways that we never even expected. And it can be They can be pretty hilarious at times. They can be pretty dreadful. But it's always something unique, unexpected, and fun.
Well, you had a lot of that, Colby, in the design of the Blackgate board game too. I mean, I remember some of the posts you wrote about the play sessions you would do, where it'd be just like, you know, this or that random event would strike, based on, you know, the system you'd created, and just, you know, the tailspin that it would sometimes throw the party into.
And that's always such a pleasant surprise when, you know, you build a system like that and it just surprises you with something you've never seen before. And it gives you ideas for new systems and whatnot. And yeah, there was some pretty, pretty good gut busters from Blackgate. I remember one was, actually it was me, Gord, and another friend, Sterling. We were playing a game, and I think, Sterl was our wizard, and he was like this, the wizard was like the new class. It was kind of untested, and I had these wands in the game that they were also untested, and the way I made them was that they were extremely powerful, like so powerful that you know, you could just blaze through dungeons and whatnot. But their drawback was that if you got a critical fail, they would just explode and you'd be left with nothing. So we were down on we were in Dungeon Hithloth on Isle of the Avatar. It was like in the furthest corner of the map, completely isolated. We all saved up and bought a boat. And Sterling was this all-powerful wizard, and we were just riding his coattails. It was just hilarious. He was just killing everything in sight, and he had so much money. And we were in a dungeon. We ran to a dragon, and he went to just liquefy it, and his wand exploded. And we just all burst out laughing. And then Gordon and I both successfully ran from combat, and leaving Sterl behind, he went to flee and he completely whiffed on it, and the dragon just chewed him in half. And the weird thing about it was that he had the compassion virtue, and the compassion virtue had a mechanic on it where if you died, you wouldn't lose anything that you were carrying with you, and he had the boat deed with him. So he respawned in his starting town with the boat deed, meaning that we couldn't use the boat to get off the island. So Gord and I were stuck on the Isle of the Avatar with a boat we couldn't use. And so our only choice was to go back in the dungeon and just start killing stuff. And I think we ended up dying as well.
That was a pretty quick death, yeah.
It was hilarious, yeah.
Nice. Yeah, but I mean, those are like, in a certain sense, I mean, that kind of, you know, harkens back to even stuff like Dungeons and Dragons, right?
Oh, you know, absolutely.
It's like,
yeah.
You know, any sort of random event, whether it's the GM's own twisted imagination or you're rolling off the random event table or things like that, right? Like, I mean, just any little shakeup that's like, okay, now the game is going to go this way.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And that's kind of the things that like that I've been trying to achieve in FDK. Just, you know, you can't rely on your plan because it's probably not going to play out the way you think it is. So, you know, you got to learn to adapt really quickly and, you know, learn to laugh at your misfortune. And
more so learn to laugh at others' misfortune.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is what's sort of the interesting thing in my mind about FDK is that It's a cooperative roguelike. So we've been in these situations before in other games where you're playing single player and misfortune happens to you and it's a bummer, you got to restart and whatnot. But it's a particularly funny brand of tragedy when it happens to your friends right in front of your eyes.
Yeah, yeah, especially when, you know, they can't get anything going. There's having, like, everybody just seems to have like out of a party of three, one person's always having just a bad run, and it's always this one person, just all this horrible things happening to. They can't find a good weapon, or keep dying, and they're just, you know, holding you back pretty much. But you just, all you can do is laugh about it. So,
but it's those lows that make the highs so much sweeter, and that's really part of FTK is the highs and the lows. The full range of emotions is what we're trying to go for in terms of the adventure. And so, yeah, those lows aren't totally necessary to get those high points when you're just, you know, when you're the king and when you're just trouncing everything in sight. So.
Well, it's interesting that, you know, you talk about the emotional highs and lows too, because I mean, you know, thinking about your comment earlier about how, you know, not to get too attached to your characters, but then right here, just above the exploration banner on the Kickstarter page, there's this, you know, another screenshot. And it's just this wonderfully little intimate scene where you've got the three characters just kind of chillaxing around a campfire. And, you know, it almost kind of invokes that saying, you know, these guys have been buddies forever. They're like the companions or something like that of the Avatar, right? They're just having a break here. I don't know if that's a posed shot or if that's going to be something that's, you know, going to be in the game. And if there's going to be that sense of companionship between the players, but that's certainly what the image evokes, right? So,
exactly.
Yeah, it's just, you know, the game is an intimate adventure, essentially. I mean, whether or not, you know, your hero lives or dies, it doesn't really matter. Along the way, you're going to see all sorts of crazy things, and you'll be with your companions, and, you know, it'll be your own adventure. It's going to be like nobody else's. So, I mean, just that intimate shot of the campfire and whatnot, it's just kind of... It's just a very common sentiment, I think, that you'd get from any sort of adventure like that.
Might be interesting, too, you know, to happen upon the points in the game where that scene would occur if you were playing with your friends, right? Like the three of you, you know, just like polish off a dungeon and then pitch a camp for the night, and then you can just kind of...
Yeah, well, we do have these little things called safe camps, and they were in Blackgate in a... more rudimentary form, but essentially you can use a tinderbox, and a tinderbox will put up a tent wherever you happen to be standing. And essentially, if you end your turn at a safe camp, you get a little bit of health, and anybody else who ends their turn on your safe camp as well can get that same health replenishment. So it's kind of like you're putting a little comfort zone somewhere out in the middle of these dangerous realms, and other players can come to them and essentially get some a little rest from the adventure. So there's other mechanics that go with it as well. That's kind of like its basic mechanic.
Nice. Speaking of exploration, and again, just kind of looking at the shots of, like, you know, the what I assume is the overworld. Is it a dual scale map then? It's like, you know, you wander on the overworld, but then when you come to a town, you get taken to like a separate screen that's the town, or...
There's the battle dioramas, which was what you've seen on the Kickstarter page. So when you encounter an enemy, you'll get kind of a more zoomed in version of that realm that you're standing in. The towns are currently just an overworld only art asset, and we'll see where it goes. We've talked a little bit about doing town dioramas and whatnot. Currently, though, they are just there's POIs on the board. So if you land in a town, a menu will pop up and give you all that exact town's options and shop prices and any services that it offers.
Okay, fair enough. I'm kind of pivoting then off, you know, your comment there to combat. So, you know, the combat really does look interesting. I mean, I have to admit, while I can fully acknowledge respect for JRPGs and what they are, I have never personally really been able to get into, you know, how something like a Final Fantasy would implement combat.
Okay.
But then again, I look at the screens here and it's just, okay, this seems a little bit more, you know, this seems a little bit more than just that, right? Like the mechanics seem a little bit more, I don't even have the right word for them, but there's just a little bit more of engagement there.
I think the word that I like to use is we're going for a little bit more of a visceral feel to them. They have weight to them, so there's not a lot of crazy summoning and meteors falling from the sky and stuff. They're very quick. They're very visceral. They're very brutal. They're often decided through only a few rounds, a few blows. So you got to be very smart about who you're attacking, how you're attacking them, and even when to attack. When you need to know when you're overpowered and you need to run. So we sort of one of the things that keeps coming up is we're trying to mimic real world-ish mechanics for whatever that's worth. And so how would a combat like this actually go down? And you know, would there be all this crazy magic and long back and forth sessions, or would it be decided by a few swipes of an axe? And so that's sort of one of the guiding forces, which is, I think, why they feel a little different than a standard JRPG battle. Yeah.
And your weapons break.
And your weapons break. Yeah. At the most inopportune times. Yeah. They will break.
Yeah. I like this picture of the ranger with his hammer. Just like, okay, I'm going in for the attack. And oh, no.
And whiff. Yeah.
Actually, is it going to be like a case where, you know, characters are going to be able to, you know, carry an entire arsenal and switch it on the fly? Or like, if my weapon breaks in combat, am I like hosed until I burn a turn on switching weapons, or will I even have multiple weapons to switch between?
You've got a belt, and currently in the game, it's not possible to equip a weapon from your belt. But in the Black Gate, I had a rule where you could keep any weapon on your belt. You could carry up to, I think, 3 items it was, and if you had a belt weapon, then you could swap it at any time, just like in Ultima 7. So, it was kind of handy if you had a kind of a weird weapon that you didn't want to use all the time, then sure, you could throw it on your belt and do the switch during combat. So I think eventually in FTK, I would like to implement belt weapons and just giving players the option to mix it up on the fly and, you know, just be like giving them the chance to be prepared for when disaster strikes. And then it's the players that aren't prepared that are going to be, you know, forced to duke it out with their fists or forced to flee from combat. So it'll kind of reward the players that kind of think ahead and whatnot. So I would like to have the belt weapons for sure.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and I see you do actually mention that here. Just above
I think I did say it in there.
Yeah, just above the Underworld Peril section, you know. Yeah, you mentioned that, right. So yeah, that'd be good. Actually, speaking of the Underworld, so the dungeons will obviously be randomly generated as well. Is it going to be like a multiple floors thing, like, you know, a Stygian Abyss, or is they going to be like one continuous thing?
It's multiple floors. So the Black Gate rules were every dungeon would start at level 1, and it would have like your typical skeletons and kind of like light enemies and kind of, you know, not so great treasure and whatnot. But when you found the card that says, okay, this dungeon is now level 2, then if you want to continue to explore this dungeon, you have to draw from the dungeon level 2 deck. And that deck was about 5 times harder. But the treasure was just spectacular. Like, all the craziest weapons were down there. So that's essentially how FTK will work. Being that it's a digital system, we can have as many floors as we want now, which is nice. I mean, in the board game, it would have been, you know, multiple decks, so I wouldn't want to have 3 or 4 decks just for the dungeons. That's just too many. But
right.
Yeah, with FTK, hopefully we'll have, you know, 3 or 4 floors per dungeon, and the difficulty just progresses with each stairwell that you find.
Nice. I have to say too, I really like the base selection of classes in the game, because they're not really the traditional classes. You know, you've got the hunter, who's kind of your rangery type, and then you've got the scholar, who's, I guess, kind of a magey type. And then you've got the blacksmith. But you know, so they kind of, there's some allusions there to, you know, the classic fighter wizard rogue combo, but not quite.
They're regular citizens. So, I mean, they're not heroes. I mean, realistically, like, how likely is it for, you know, just, you know, a knight to stop what he's doing and go save the world or whatever? I mean, it's just, obviously that's not going to happen, but I mean, if it were to happen, it would be a regular person like you or I, and these are just regular Joes that, you know, recognized what was happening in the world, and you know, they respected their king enough that they're dropping their everything they did and everything, you know, all the responsibilities that they had, and they said, okay, let's just solve this crisis right now. So these are just regular people of Ferul, and they're just being forced into a very unfortunate situation.
Right. And so So that is kind of the framing plot of the game then. Like the king has been assassinated.
Yeah.
And the queen, it says here, it says the queen has put out a desperate call to, you know, to the citizens, as you mentioned, to just, you know, to rise up and help stem the tide of impending doom, as you put it. So you probably don't want to add too much to that, but
there is more to it, but it's, you know, we don't want to spoil anything. And also, I mean, we're still pre-alpha. So, I mean, some of the plot points and story elements aren't 100% in place yet. I think we know basically what we want to happen, but there's still some elements that we're kind of massaging to work with the mechanics and whatnot. So, I mean, even if we could tell you what the story was, it might not be the same as what it is when we launch. So,
right.
Leave it at that, I guess.
Yeah, no. And I'm just kind of looking over the rest here. I mean, okay. So, you know, you do have the scourges, but then you also, of course, have the system of deities. now, do those two play off each other at all? So, you know, because you kind of mention them together. So I'm just like wondering that. I mean, obviously, you know, we already talked about the scourges a little bit, but you do have this section where, you know, you mentioned like the helpful gods of Ferul, and the ability to like devote yourself to a deity, become their paragon. and you talk about some of the special benefits that might come with that, up to and including possibly resurrection, as long as you don't abuse their power. But like, do the gods and the scourges kind of, are those systems that play off each other? Like one can, you know, being a paragon can help
one
fight
scourge
a scourge
that actually prohibits players from devoting themselves to a god. So they don't all work well together. For the most part, they're very much individuals. The gods each have their own kind of identity, and they give you individual bonuses and whatnot, like buffs and all sorts of perks and whatnot, and kind of like some combat elements that they can help you with, like defensive abilities. And the scourges they work very much the same way. They are very individual villains, and they don't really acknowledge each other or whatnot. So they don't. There's not much overlap there. When they're in their game, they're doing their own thing. And but yeah, the one scourge that does not allow players to devote themselves to a god is called. She's actually one of the characters from Sean's chapters that he was writing on the Iron Oak website. I don't know if you have seen any of those, but there's a character called Warden Fraby, and she's a priest. And so she's been converted into a scourge, essentially. And so she's got some pretty horrible things that she can cause when she enters the game now. So she's pretty cool. I can't wait to get her in.
Nice. I do remember a reference to her. I don't know if I read all of the piece of lore surrounding her, but I do remember the warden character popping up.
So. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. I don't know. Like,
there's a lot. I know it goes on and on. We're kind of surprised actually by the time we were finished all the, you know, the fine tuning on our campaign, how much stuff we really had. So
there is, but you know, like it's on that same, by the same token, like it's so, in some respects, scrolling down it, it's easy to see, you know, why you've done so well and why you're able to build and seemingly sustain the momentum that you have. Because, you know, like, it's really, really, I mean, it's very complete. It really demonstrates, you know, like, just the level of thought that's been put into this. And it does, you know, as you said, show off a game that's already, like, in a really healthy state. So, is it not hard to see, you know, what the draw was there, for sure.
Thank you.
And such a small team.
Yeah, we've managed to accomplish quite a bit. I mean, there's been a lot of prep work going into the game. So, I mean, all the work going into just the Blackgate Unity prototype and everything. I mean, obviously, we're not using any of that code or anything now, but it's kind of greased the wheels in the entire process. So, I mean, it's made it much easier for us to make strides when developing FTK.
Definitely. If you don't mind my asking, like, how did you pull everyone together? I mean, obviously, I know you and Gord know each other already. But you know, how did everybody else, and I'm assuming Sean Hoyle is also one of the ones that's kind of within that circle, but you know, how did you pull in David and how did you pull in John and who else did you mention here? Well, you mentioned
Gord, you want to answer that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, yeah, there's a few people that have helped us out in varying capacities. We have Chad and Henry and Gabe, our concept artist, and I knew a lot of them. So before working on FTK, I was working at Clay Entertainment, the guys who do Don't Starve. And I worked with Dave there. And so that's where I knew Dave from. And so, he had left Clay about a month or two before I did. And so when it came time for me to make the jump to go full time on For the King, I immediately gave Dave a call because I knew he had just left Clay, and I was hoping that he was still, that he didn't have another job. And fortunately, he didn't, and he was fully game. Once you know, we met with him, showed him the game. He was pretty easy to convince.
Yeah.
And then the other guys, yeah, because we're a small team, there are some things that are just completely out of our wheelhouse, and that's like audio and animation. And you know, together, we have over 27 years experience as a team, in the industry. So we have a lot of contacts. We know a lot of people. So it was quite easy to find help for all those areas that, that, you know, we just felt that it would be better left to someone else to do. Yeah, it just sort of came together organically. You know, you know someone who knows someone, and they point you in the direction of someone else, and that's sort of how we met our composer. It was through just a series of interconnected relationships. So yeah, it all kind of just came together organically, but I think it was driven by just our... go ahead.
It was a long process too.
I mean, it was
like,
yeah.
It wasn't just like, you know, we snapped our fingers and I had a whole bunch of people working on the game. It was, I mean, Sean was the very first person that I contacted just because I know how creative he is and whatnot. And then you joined, and then we talked to then Chad joined, and then, you know, Chad knew one of our audio guys, and the audio guy knew our composer, and this is like a series of events over, you know, a year probably. So I mean, it was just kind of a slow gathering of people, and now we got a team. So
yeah, well, that's awesome. And I mean, the team seems to work really, really well overall, because, you know, again, what you've been able to produce and really in not that much time is, you know, really good. I mean, I remember watching the teaser trailer back in July, and it's just like, wow.
I was all gored, so.
Well, no, I mean, I couldn't have done it without the code and stuff. It's all of us really working together. And, you know, we had a large part of that. We knew exactly what game we were making right from the get-go because of the Blackgate prototype. And then the work that Colby did in Unity to prototype the digital version. And I'm pretty sure Dave's been coding for 50 years or something like that. So
you're 100, I don't know.
Yeah, he's unbelievably fast and proficient. He's launched a bunch of games that he's done solo. He's been through that process many, many times. And we're focused, and it just sort of works. Yeah. We know what tools to use. And we basically know how to get things done, and we're super passionate about it. It didn't come without a lot of hard work and not a lot of time off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's been stressful, to say the least.
It's been stressful, but well worth it for sure. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Definitely. Well, and it's cool to see this go so far. I mean,
absolutely.
You know, I've been watching the Ultima fan community for a long, long time, and it's, you know, it's really cool to see these success stories come out of it, right? You know, whether it's someone who, you know, like they start with a project and then they kind of turn it around and go and try and do their own thing. I mean, there were other projects that have tried to do that and utterly failed. You know, so the fact that you're able to do that is wonderful. You know, just as much as it's like, you know, cool to see, you know, like a guy like Ian Fraser, spearhead and lead the Ultima 5 Lazarus project team.
Right.
And then pivot off of that. And, you know, now he's like lead designer for Mass Effect. So, you know, it's wonderful to see those stories actually happen, to see them come out of this community. That's really, really cool. So,
you know, it's mostly just dedication. I mean, it's just setting yourself to do something and then sticking to it. I mean, unfortunately, it's probably going to take you many years to complete that goal. But, you know, once you have finished it, then you're so much better off than you were before. So you've learned so much along the way. And yeah, it's just a matter of just sticking to it and just being passionate for whatever you do.
Yeah. Well, that is, again, just awesome work, guys. We're coming up on the hour mark, and I don't always succeed, but I try to keep the episodes at about that mark. So,
fair enough.
I'm just going to, you know, quickly fire out a couple of little things and then we can kind of all say goodnight. So again, you know, for everybody, we've been talking with Colby and Gord. They're at Iron Oak Games. They're, a couple of the people behind For the King, a really exciting looking, RPG roguelike adventure that's currently on Kickstarter. Totally suggest backing the game. Totally suggest checking out the website.
I agree.
Of Iron Oak Games, which will all be in the show notes. I'll throw in, like, you've got a Facebook page, I think, and Twitter. You on Google Plus?
We are, but not very well.
Kind of. Yeah. it's so foreign to me. Every time I look at it, I'm like, what am I doing? I don't get it.
It's mostly true of all of Google Plus, I think.
Yeah.
Its main utility, I think, is what we're doing right now, a Hangout. but I'll definitely make sure to put, like, all your social media in the show notes as well, and the Kickstarter and the website. So definitely, for those of you listening, For the King, really cool-looking game. Just such beautiful art. Really promising little thing. A really promising design. By all means, check it out, back it. They have this great $59 tier. You know, you can get like 3 copies of the game for you and your friends. Totally go for that. And actually, you can get additional copies of the game as add-ons, can't you?
Yep, that's right.
Yeah, you totally added.
T-shirts as well.
Ooh, t-shirts, well. Are there healing potions in the game?
There's healing herbs.
Okay.
So the entire game uses a herb system. So no potions, but yeah, we kind of wanted to steer clear of some of the more typical tropes. So we kind of developed this herb system. So there's many herbs in the game that do many different things.
Okay. The only reason I ask is because, you know, you mentioned t-shirts, and I'm just like, oh yeah, I had this one idea for a t-shirt a while ago. So real healing potions are yellow.
In the world of Britannia, yes, they are.
Yeah. Anyways, just quickly say, to the audience, of course, always remember, if you'd like to recommend anyone for a shout out, send us an email. You can always use that to suggest podcast topics, offer commentary, criticism, volunteer your time as a contributor. There's the Ultima Dragons Facebook group. There's the Ultima Dragons Google Plus community thing. There's the UDIC hashtag on Twitter. Whatever your preferred flavor of social media is, consider hopping in on one of those. The Ultima series has a Facebook page. The Ultima Codex has a Twitter account and a Google Plus page, which, you know, is about as well established as any other Google Plus page, but whatever, whatever social network you favor, please consider sharing content posted there to your own social media profile. If it's something that's interesting to you, and, do the same for these guys, do the same for the King, you know, they talked a lot about how word of mouth really got the campaign going. And, you know, by all means, keep doing that. And then finally, if you like spam, spam, spam humbug, leave us a review. iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean. It just helps, you know, with the visibility. And the Patreon. I've talked enough about the Patreon. Not a big deal. So, on that note, thank you again, both of you, for taking the time tonight. This was really, really great. I hope this adds to the buzz.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, truly thanks so much for having us. Yeah.
All right.
Do it again.
Well, you know what? We can always do a follow-up. I mean, it's no question now that you're going to have a successful Kickstarter campaign. That was that you've already crossed that hurdle. So it'll definitely be great to see, you know, what you're able to do, how far you're able to take this, what your final total is going to be, and then of course what that is going to mean for the future of the game. So thank you both.
All right, thank you.
Say
good night. If you want to say good night to the audience, by all means do.
Good night, everyone.
Good thanks night, everyone.
Okay, see you later.
Yeah, be virtuous.